Yeah, because today we'll be talking about
the power of sound. And just as a warning, you may get hit by something, the sound, and it does have consequences. That will be one of the topics that we talk about today. We haven't started yet. But another way we kind of have. Thanks for coming. It's great to have you all here.
Hello everyone, we welcome all of you on behalf of Conscious Living at Salesforce. As a part of Conscious Living at Salesforce, we bring the culture of ancient yoga, wisdom, and practices to our workplace. We have monthly tasks, talks, and bi-weekly meditation sessions. Vaisheshika Das, veteran monk, author, and spiritual guide, travels throughout the world sharing knowledge gained from 4 decades of bhakti yoga practice and dedication to spiritual entrepreneurialism. Speaking at corporations, universities, and nonprofits, he teaches universal principles of personal spiritual development. Renowned for his wisdom and inspiring speech, he has a way of making ancient wisdom and practices relevant and accessible. In this talk, we will learn how spiritual evolution begins with the tongue. Change your speech, change your life. And let's hear more from Vaisheshika. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it is true, I've been practicing bhakti yoga for over 40 years. And also, I've been mixing it up with life itself, which I have lived now for about 63 years. I just had my 63rd birthday yesterday. So the two actually go well together because one way or another, you have to actually live in the world and interact. And I find, as is suggested by the ancient teachings of yoga, that the two go well together. We have to have some counterbalance. I have to have some counterbalance to the ways of the world, the complexities that come up. And they're both internal and external, but one of the philosophies of yoga is that they're mostly internal because we don't see the world the way it is, we see the world the way we are, which is, the gain's a little high. Oh, you got it. And one of the ways in which one can go quickly to the essence of the practice of yoga, which comes from the word yuj in Sanskrit, which means to connect. And connect to what? Connect to our original source. And that means also in yoga, alignment. And there's an idea that through alignment, we actually find happiness. When we're out of alignment, there's a kind of friction or vibration in my life. But through alignment, I feel naturally peaceful, happy, insightful, because that's my nature. But when I'm distracted and when my energy, which is my conscious energy, goes out and ricochets off the various multitude, I should say, of objects in the world, then, as the Bhagavad Gita puts it, there's bahu shaka hinantascha. There's a way in which my intentions get bifurcated or mini-branched. Bahu shaka means mini-branched, and I get distracted in a way that causes me to lose sight of my higher self. And speaking of which, there is a description of the difference between my body, which is definitely a self, but it's only here for a little while. It's like a car. I identify with my car, and I say, that's my car, that's me, actually. Or if someone says, there goes the president, generally what happens is you look out and you'll see a motorcade going by. And so in a similar way, the body is called also a field, a kshetra, but it's a young field. We just got it recently, a few years ago. in my case, 63 years ago, but that's still pretty recent, even in geological time. And then there's a more ancient self. Are you comfortable over there? Because we have front row seats up here. We saved them for you, if you like. Okay, that sounds good. At any time anybody wants to transfer closer, feel free. I'm vegetarian. What was I saying?
Your new body.
The young
yes.
Yeah.
Then we have what's called the psychological body. So there are two bodies, actually. I'm an embodied spirit, according to the ancient texts. And what am I embodied by? Two different bodies. One is called the gross physical body. And it's really this, what you see in front of you now. And now I'm demonstrating one of the mechanical elements of the body, which could be described, how would you say best what I'm doing now? What mechanical function is this?
Bending.
Bending by what mechanism?
Joint.
Lever? Mm. Like kind of a lever and a pulley type of thing. And then I've got a heart that's more like a pump. Yeah, decidedly a pump. And there's all kinds of different functions that go on in the gross physical body. And then we have what's called the psychological body, which is composed of what's described as the citta. And that really is made up of the mind, the intellect, and the what's called the ahankar, or it's a subtle element, it's called false ego, which connects me to the spiritual substance within the body, to the external world. The conscious self is called the Atma. So one of the important aspects of the study of yoga, or I should say practical aspects, is categorizing and prioritizing energy. And there's a description of lower and higher energies. Why is this important? It's important because where attention goes, energy flows. Wherever I project my consciousness, I'm going to end up in that place. And when I project myself into lower energy, then I become absorbed, or it's what it's called in Sanskrit, abhinivesita. I'm absorbed in a myriad of anxieties, complexities, and so forth, and I'm carried away by what's called the lower energy, the material energy. And when I'm able to identify a higher energy and focus my attention there, then I experience an entirely different set of feelings and have different experiences, which are described as happiness, compassion, an awareness of life within others. I see the body, but I'm actually feeling the life within the other bodies. So there's a sense that's actually expressed in the Constitution of the United States. Everyone was created equally. On the physical level, you won't find much equality because everybody's different one way or the other. But where is that equality coming from the spiritual level? And we intuit that you know, we're all equal on that level. But through the practice of mantra meditation, and which is under the umbrella of yoga, one comes to have this vision of equality and treating people, every living being, with respect. These are some of the symptoms of what is called the yogic state or spiritual consciousness. And so today, there are a few points that are more specific and practical. The first is that you're a creator. And a question was posed on the marquee, the electronic marquee, announcing this class, what is your mantra? And we could say, in one way, that everything we say is a kind of mantra. In fact, one of my colleagues likes to say the world runs by mantra. Like he said, please open the door. That was a mantra. And somebody opens the door. Please pass me the salt. The salt comes to you magically because you said it. When I was a kid, there was I forget what movie it came from, or a cartoon, but there was Open Sesame, and things would open. And we tried on everything, see if it would open or move. And I also I think my parents took me to an old movie when I was a kid about flying carpets, and they did some mantra and the carpet would fly. I think those movies have come back recently in animated form. But it's endlessly fascinating, the use of mystical powers. Well, we all have them. And it's just a matter of focusing them in order to achieve the result we're looking for. The point that the Vedas, which I'll refer to, Vedas is easy, it just means knowledge. They're books of knowledge, and there are different categories of knowledge in the Vedas, and there's a distinctly spiritual aspect to the Vedas. And they go into a discussion of the ways in which we can focus our own energies. Primarily, that's where we place our attention at any given time during the day, and we organize our life around that, to achieve the highest possible result. And when we are aware that what we hear is has consequence, and what we speak has consequence, every word we say has a consequence. And there is a difference between spiritual sound vibration and material sound vibration. So the Vedas then say concisely, anavritti shabdat. And that is, by a higher vibration, shabda, anavritti, you can become uncovered or free from the mire of what is called illusion or anxiety and all the kinds of things that illusion produces. And so in a very practical sense, one has to refine one's speech. And one of the most refined types of speech is mantra. Speech itself is interesting because, I mean, the word language comes from the word logos, which describes a categories of energy in the world. And the way that we order our speech will order our thoughts. And of course, the way we're thinking will dictate what comes out of our mouth. So we have an integral relationship between our speech and the way the world around us is ordered. And vice versa, what we say has a consequence, it comes back to our own consciousness. So those are a few introductory thoughts, and I just want to ask you if you heard anything so far that stuck in your mind, any concept. You can just reflect it back. We have an extra microphone too, so we'll be able to hear you, and everyone on the bridge can hear you too.
That every word has a consequence. And I had read something similar very recently also, that other people's perception of your words, that's creating a kind of a mind of their own that then they spread to others, so it can travel too.
Yes, thank you for remembering that. Every word has a consequence. And I'll read you a quote that I picked up before I came here. And this is from an author, Betty Ady. She said, "If we understood the power of our thoughts, we would guard them more closely. If we understood the awesome power of our words, we would prefer silence to almost anything negative. In our thoughts and words, we create our own weaknesses and our own strengths."
I think, thank you for being here. I think for me, it ties back to what you said, is your words do have consequence, but they are also a reflection of your intention. And so for me, it begins with intention.
Such a good point. Thank you so much for bringing that up. I mean, what is intention anyway? When you think about it, it has the word ten in it, just like the word tendon. The bones and muscles are held together by tendons. And the way in which we connect with the world is through our intention. And not only that, and this is one of the points that comes up in the teachings of mantra, and in yoga in general, which begins, interestingly, with our speech, is that sound carries consciousness. The consciousness that we have within us gets manifested through our speech. And not just, I mean, there's an old saying that a fool is not discovered until he or she speaks. Have you ever heard that? Maybe well-dressed, but then he's like, here's a mic, and they're like, uh-oh. Or there's, he had nothing to say, and then he said it. So there's lots of ways in which we recognize speech as manifesting what's internal, but in a very subtle way, it actually carries consciousness. And there's a tone to the speech, there's a vibration. Of course, that goes without saying, because it is a vibration. And the whole world is vibrational. It's made up of vibration, according to quantum physics. And therefore, there are terms like, have you ever heard someone say, I don't like your tone? Was it good when they said that? Not really. I don't like your tone. You might have said the right thing, but then someone says, hey, wait a minute. You know, you didn't mean it, or it was sarcasm. How do you detect sarcasm, for instance? You know, it's like, it's the timing, but it's also there's a quality to the vibration. So this is a very important point. What the intention is in the heart, I mean, where does intention come from? It doesn't come from a dead stone. It comes from a conscious entity. Intention, volition, any kind of active force of creation or of feeling in a certain way and having a desire comes from the active consciousness. And that's the Atma within. And through the speech, it gets manifested. What to speak of the fact that there's speech is creative in many ways. For instance, there as a definition of what's called authorized speech that comes out in the Vedas. And an example that's given is if you go to court and the judge issues her verdict and says, you're awarded $1 million. Do you get $1 million? Yeah. Well, I mean, you got to collect it. But basically, by law, yes. Why? Because she said it. Now, if she's standing down by the 7-Eleven and you're walking out of the store, and she's the same person and says, you get $1 million, you may not take it seriously. But in a certain context, when it's authorized speech, when it's lined up through a certain channel and a certain at a certain time, then the speech acts. It has its power. Another example of the power of speech. What other things did you hear? We'll take two more. Yes.
Alignment equals happiness.
Alignment equals happiness. Yes. We talked in one of these classes about the words which mean happiness and distress in Sanskrit. So sukha and dukkha. Sanskrit can be, and it's a very rich language, has many meanings to certain words. So one of the meanings behind duk, which means unhappiness, which means to be out of alignment. An example is an axle in the wheels of a cart or a vehicle of any kind, and if it's out of alignment, then there's going to be friction, even fire, and so forth, and you'll feel really unsteady. So yes, being properly aligned, and that's really the ultimate meaning of yoga. Huge, to be correctly aligned. Good, thank you. How about one more? Anything you heard that's stuck in your mind? Like mango sap. If you get it in your hair, you can't get it out.
I have another one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Go for it.
He said something along the lines, the way the world is and the way we are. Can
yes.
you talk a little bit about that?
I said we don't see the world the way it is. We see the world the way we are. I mean, this is common fare, actually, but it fits into this, the context of this talk. But the way it's described in the Vedas, and particularly in the Bhagavad Gita, is that we have a certain way of interpreting the world based on our modality. And there are three basic modalities in the world. They're the lowest of them, which is called tamas, which is a very dark energy. And then above that is called rajas, which is a very active energy. It's characterized by unlimited desires and longings and constant movement. And then there's sattva, which is a very serene and illuminating mode. So these three modes are called gunas, and they are what interact within this world in various ways, and there are unlimited combinations and permutations of these modes of nature. However, some of them are at certain times predominant. This relates to your question because the Vedas describe that there's a way in which, because of how I live and the kinds of things I hear, the kinds of food I eat, every life situation I'm in, it's developing a prominence of a predominance of a certain modality within my mind and my body. And let's say if I'm in the mode of darkness, this lower mode, I'll look at the world differently than somebody who's, for instance, in the mode of sattva, or this higher mode of light. And an example that's given there is, a person who's in this light, higher energy has a great respect for other life forms, because he or she sees that behind every physical body, there's an animating force which is spiritual, and it's a very high energy. And that person is relating to that more than just the body that he or she's seeing. And doesn't discriminate even humans, animals, plants. They have like respect for everything that's alive. And somebody more in Rajas tends to see things more in terms of the physical external body, and will say like, well, you're an American and you're from somewhere else, and you're a man, you're a woman. It makes the really categorical decisions based on seeing the differences. And then in the mode of ignorance, a person can't distinguish anything. And they just tend to be self-destructive and destructive towards others. So this is an example when information comes to somebody in the mode of the higher mode of sattva, they'll interpret it very differently from somebody in Rajas or Tamas. And this is the way in which one sees the world, because the world's being reflected through our senses onto the mind, the surface of the mind. And if the mind is affected in a certain way, we're seeing the world in a distorted way. Much like once when I was flying on a long trip to Japan, and I had been sleeping, and I got up and I went into those tiny little restrooms, and I looked in the mirror and I said, oh my God, my head is lopsided. And I thought, you know, airline seats, sleeping, I don't know what happened. Like, how am I going to speak when I get there? I look like a monster. And then I moved 2 inches to the right and I said, oh, okay. It was a blemish in the mirror. You know, not that my head is perfectly round as it is, but it was bad. And so for a fleeting second there, while I was half awake, I thought, you know, I'm a monster. So there's a way in which the surface of the mind is described to be like Chetodarpana Marjanam. It means a mirror, a reflective surface. So I'm seeing the world, but if the mirror itself is dirty or contaminated in some way, then I see things in that way. And the modalities are what affect the mind. So in the card that I handed out today, I mentioned a few points about the yogic lifestyle, which is that, or maybe I didn't, but I will now. The way we organize ourselves in our lives, the modes we expose ourselves to throughout the day and week after week will determine how we look at the world, because that's how we develop ourselves. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you so much for putting this together. And on the topic, you are the creator.
Yes.
I feel like this is really true, because for me internally, the story that I tell myself, that I rewrite myself to reveal and retrospect it, and to be looking back at different time of the age, it changed as I grow older to gain the wisdom and the clarity of it. When I was young, decision was made, and it was different time then. So how we are, as we grow older, how do we shed the things that are no longer true or untrue to go forward, to claim clarity, to claim oneness, wholeness, nice is love overall. And yeah, that understanding.
That's such an important point. Thank you very much. There's a way in which our words about ourselves, how we're telling our own story about who we are and so forth, affect us. We also notice that what other people tell us that we take in may affect us in a long-term way. And I don't know, even in an immediate sense, if somebody walks up to you and says, you look tired, then how do you feel?
I'm tired.
or somebody walks up and goes, boy, you look terrible. How do you feel?
Maybe I look terrible.
I mean, it goes in. And you might look in the mirror and go, yeah, I do look terrible. But if somebody walks up to you and says, hey, you look spiritual, all of a sudden you're like, hey, actually I am spiritual. It sort of cuts through the coverings all of a sudden, because that's actually our identity, beyond these two bodies that we're transporting ourselves, that are transporting us through time and across geography. So, yes, very important. The story we tell us, in fact, there was a quote I saw here that says, I am. Two of the most powerful words for what you put after them shapes your reality. You know, and if you say, I am, like if I say, I am an American, I mean, I am, I can prove it, I have a passport. But the fact is, once I say I'm an American, that, you know, that puts me in a certain context. I could say, I am, I could say it in many different ways, and it would, the way I tell the story about who I am is indicative of my consciousness, and will start to give me a certain frame of reference. But speaking of frames of reference, we're going to take a couple of minutes for a guided meditation, because it's extremely important, according to the Vedas, to take time every day to introspect. And there's a interesting point about our own conscious self, our own conscious selves, and that is that we are made of light energy. Now, light itself is self-evident. For instance, when the sun comes up in the morning, nobody has to inform you, because you can tell for yourself. Am I correct about that? And in a similar way, there's a description of the experience of alignment, of spiritual awakening or connection, which is describes how when you're hungry and you eat food, you feel naturally satisfied and your hunger goes away and you feel nourished. And nobody needs to give you a certificate, because you know for yourself. I've always wondered about that. How do you know when you're hungry? You ever thought about that? You just are. And how do you know when you're satisfied? You know, right? You know. So in a similar way, through introspection, and especially guided by mantra meditation, there's a way in which you can connect daily to your higher self, the Atma, and experience the nature of yourself beyond the two physical bodies, gross and subtle. And that's really important, because once you have that perspective, it gives you an awareness that I'm not necessarily part of all these thoughts that are going through my mind. They're being manufactured at a certain level. I'm not obligated to hold on to them. I'm not obligated to hold on to the whole life situation that's going around me and say that this is me and I have to become stressed about everything that's happening. So let's try this really simple form of meditation called mantra meditation. And I'm going to introduce two mantras in this session. One of them is written here. It's only one syllable, Om. And this is a seed mantra that you'll find throughout the Vedas. And Om is like a zip file. When you see the icon on your screen, it may look insignificant, and it may look like nothing's really there. But when you click on it, then it becomes manifest and all the various files come out. So in the same way with Om, it's like a seed or a zip file, and you open it by giving it your attention, and you just listen to the vibration. So we're going to try that as a mantra. It's a very recognized mantra by people who know the Vedas. It's been around the world many times. In fact, you'll see it written places. And it's convenient. You can carry it in your pocket. It's one syllable. Then, after that, I'm going to introduce you to this mantra that I've written very phonetically. And it goes like this. Nitai Gauranga. And if you'll just try it one time by following the bouncing ball.
Nitai Gauranga.
Perfect. This is a mantra which is said to be very helpful in it, coming to spiritual consciousness, because it removes all your obstacles. The obstacles of self-doubt or any of the fog that's around your consciousness. The Nitai Gauranga mantra is very powerful. And it's also meant to invoke the happiness within your heart, so that whatever other spiritual practice you do, it opens you up and clears the path for you. So I'll take us just into a meditation, and then I'll begin by saying the mantra. And if you'll, I'll say it in unison, it'll have a particular effect of the group. And also, I encourage you, if you can, to count the mantras. And if you hold up your right hand, you don't have to make a vow. I'm just going to show you how to count. And one is here in between the two sections on your ring finger. Say one.
One.
Now move it down one section to the bottom. Two.
Two.
Bottom of the little finger, say three.
Three.
Middle of the little finger, say four.
Four.
Top of the little finger, say five.
Five.
Top of the ring finger, say six.
Six.
Top of the middle finger, say seven.
Seven.
Top of the index finger, say eight.
Eight.
Middle of the index finger, say nine.
Nine.
And bottom of the index finger, say ten.
Ten.
So the reason I bring this up is one of the practices of mantra meditation is to count your mantras. Because if you are consistent in chanting your mantras every day, and you count a certain number of mantras that you do, then you'll start to notice the effect. Just like when you go to the doctor, and he or she says, you know, take the full course. Don't stop halfway through. So in the same way, with the mantras, it's like a kind of medicine at first, and starts to clear things out for you. But take the full course. If you're taking it 3 days and all of a sudden you go like, I'm better, I don't need it anymore, or I don't feel like it today, then you won't get the full effect. So you want to, especially we have a 21-day challenge, you know, to do it for 21 days and do your mantra every day, and then you'll definitely develop a new good habit. Okay, so I'll be doing these two mantras, and if you'll just find a comfortable position and sit up just a slight bit straighter than you were a second ago. And then bring your attention to your breath. And it helps to get started on focusing on your breath, because the mind is fickle and wants to run here and there, by mentally saying in when you inhale. And as you naturally exhale, say out. And keep bringing your attention back to your breath. It also helps if you notice on the flares of your nostril that you can actually feel the air coming in and out if you're breathing through your nose. And you can bring your attention to that sensation and really focus there. Focus helps to expand the citta or the consciousness. And you may notice that there are competing thoughts. But while you're in this state of introspection, just notice the thoughts. But give yourself permission just for a while to not react to them. You don't have to respond to any of them. You can look at them as clouds passing through your internal environment and just let them go. Now, move your attention to your right foot. And notice that you have the power to adjust your attention and project it in any way that you like. You were concentrating on your breath, and now on your right foot, you'll notice the sensation in your foot. Your consciousness pervades your entire physical body, and there's conscious energy within your foot, and you can become aware of it right now. Now move your attention to your left hand and feel that there's life there in your hand and that you are the one deciding where to place your attention. Now move your attention, your main asset in life, or your only real asset, to your heart space. Herein is a center of energy, according to the Vedas, where you live. The Vedas describe how in the external world, there's struck sound. It comes from friction and air moving through and touching your ear and relaying a message to your brain. But internally, in your heart region, there's unstruck sound. It's not physical sound, it's spiritual sound. And the sound vibration that emanates from the heart chakra is Om. By physically pronouncing the mantra Om, you can align yourself with that spiritual unstruck sound that's already there within the heart. And this brings you to a connection with your higher self. I'm going to say one Om, and you can listen. And then together, we'll count 10 ohms. And if you like, you can count on your right hand in the method I just showed you. When we get to the end, we'll stop. And we'll feel how the vibration has affected us. Together for 10 ohms. And just sit silently for about 10 seconds and feel that the vibration has penetrated. It goes into your ears, it goes into your cells. And there's a resonance with the unstruck sound of Om within your heart. And now I'll pronounce the next mantra, Nitai Gauranga. And after I say it one time, we'll say it together 10 times. Nitai Gauranga. 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 And now just sit for a minute and feel the effects of the mantra. It's like a sound highway. It takes you to the higher realm of your consciousness just by writing the mantra. And the world is run by mantra, but you get to decide which mantras you introduce in your personal life. If you choose the mantras that have been passed down through spiritual channel, you can taste for yourself the difference between that and the lower vibrations that come out of the combinations and permutations of worldly speech, including gossip, daily news, and all kinds of other information that may simply agitate your mind. We'll take one last inhale. And to finish the session, we'll say Om together. So please inhale when you can. Om. Wiggle your feel your toes and your fingers. You can place your hands on your chest and feel that external physical body. Open your eyes and come back into San Francisco, California. Welcome back. So one of the ways to train the mind, which is the object of meditation and yoga, is to practice daily mantra meditation. It's one of the easiest kinds of meditation because the sound has a special power in and of itself. It introduces a kind of resonance that will help lift you from whatever situation you're in to a higher perspective. So I recommend what's called numerical strength, and that is picking a certain number of mantras and doing them every day.
I have a question about that.
Yes, please.
There's a lot of texts that talk about the significance of practicing sets of 100.
Is that all?
There's a lot of literature that talks about the importance of practicing sets of 108.
Yes.
Which I find interesting, not so much as a number, but because that ratio does seem to to be inherent in the structure of our solar system.
Yes.
You know, the sun is 108 sun distances from Earth. The moon is 108 Earth distances from Earth. The sun is exactly 108 Earth diameters wide, which is interesting as a ratio.
I'm glad you're telling me that, because people everywhere I go in the world ask me, why 108?
And I have to say, I have been practicing that for a couple of years on my own, and it does seem significant in some way, but I don't know why or how.
Well, it is pervasive. I just got back from Japan, and all the temples there, they introduce the same thing, 108. All over Asia, you'll find 108. And I liked your explanations just fine. It was very nice. Every culture has its own explanation of the 108. Some of them are more esoteric, and some of them are more calibrated to the physical world. But I think you're onto something there. And I'm going to, if you don't mind, I'm going to use that next time I go. So one point is actually taking up a practice of mantra meditation. You'll find that it's an aid to your sense of well-being, and also the mantra itself can become your friend. And if you research the mantra a little bit, you'll see that it's actually a kind of medicine. And just as when you go to a physician that you respect and has a track record, you might also take a mantra, and then even in the interim period when you're not experiencing 100% bliss at every second, you may take it as medicine and feel naturally good about that, because you're confident that you got it from a good source. Another point, trying to give some practical points here, is to take time to introspect every day. Don't miss it. It's the greatest show on earth. According to the Vedas, the most remarkable thing in the world is you. You're your higher self. So don't miss seeing it because of being externally focused all the time, which is easy to do nowadays because there's too much to do. Do you agree with me on that?
Yes.
I mean, you'll never get done. Well, maybe you will. I'll never finish with the to-do list. And it keeps multiplying because there's so many channels of information coming in. And that could really run me ragged. It's possible to do that. So if I take time to introspect and I see what is the source of my own self, and I experience it, even a tiny, tiny bit, even a molecule of experience there goes a long way into even my integration into the outside world. I become more capable of dealing with all kinds of circumstances that in other ways may be trying. Then the other point that is made in the yoga tests is to look at the world and accept its transitoriness. And that is a fact, that everything's moving along. And the more flexible I can be, and that comes as a result of my ability to experience my own steady self, that's the observer of the world, learn to practice flexibility and learn to allow things to change. Don't try to hold them in place constantly. I mean, I try to hold the body in place constantly. And, you know, there's different ways of doing that. And I'm trying to keep that one image, but it's a fluid entity. It's always moving like a river, and so is the whole world around me. So don't be attached to everything that happens. Let it be. And now we'll take a few reflections. Okay, good. We have a little time. A few reflections from anything that we've done so far, or talked about, or experienced in the meditation. Yes. And now, for the sake of us not getting screamed at by all the very nice people on the internet who are watching,
So this is more of a question, actually. The two mantras we practiced are very much about kind of creating certain maybe vibrations, and they're very much about the tone and quality in that way. You know, mantra is also used to refer to like statements people use as repetition to for intention. And I'm curious to know what your thought is on that, or if that interplays at all, or if that's kind of a totally separate camp.
Well, it's indicative of what I was saying, that the word language comes from logos, which has a very deep meaning, that there are categories of energy that are organized that can be described by language. They already exist and they have an inextricable connection. That's why there's a sense of when we say any of the ologies comes from the word logos. And because there's a sense in nature, there's a natural order. That's what it means, that there's a logos that can be described and that goes back to our original source. The Vedas say to Janmadya Salyataha, everything comes from one original source, that from which everything else emanates. And so it all has, there's a unity to all things. Even in the material world, all the variety, and that's a miracle unto itself, that everything is unique. There's not one particle in the universe, or one person, or one circumstance that's the same exactly as another. It's all unique. But at the same time, there's a unity to it. It's called unity and diversity, or achinta beda beda tattva. Even though it's all one, it's one thing, but it has unlimited variety. So what was your question? Why don't you restate one more time? I interrupt myself quite frequently.
But that was very, very interesting, and definitely relates. My question was, just the notion of more verbal mantras that are known statements versus the more abstract kind of utterances or sounds.
Yes, what a good point. I wrote down a definition of mantra, which says something. It's a transformational phrase, a phrase that can cause transformation. Of course, you could say that about anything, because if you say, please close the door, I just changed the environment because somebody can just close the door. But there are higher mantras and lower mantras, just as I was describing how there's higher energy and lower energy. And when you get into the esoterics of mantra, you'll find from the ancient tradition of the Vedas that many of the mantras are personal. They refer to, you know, energy sources that are coming actually from higher beings, if I may. And so there's just like you, may have a nickname. I'm not going to ask you to tell us what it is, right? Because if you tell us, then, I mean, that's a very personal thing, right? Does anybody here have a nickname? Maybe. And so let's just say if you're walking in a city you've never been in before, where might that be? Bora Bora. Is that fair? And then somebody rolls down the window of their car, and then they yell your nickname at you. You'll suddenly think, like, this person knows me. There's some connection. So in the some of these mantras, there's a way in which they're very esoteric meanings, that it's connected. We're connected on a higher level. And that's there's something in a name. Like we say, did you get his name? You get the name, then you can look up everything. You find out, you know, everything about the person. So as I was saying about the zip file, so, you know, some mantras are meant for more mundane operations. They're dealing more with the lower energy. And there's some that are dealing more directly with a higher channel of spiritual energy. Okay. Yes.
Two questions, both kind of short. Does it make sense to practice a mantra if you have no idea what the words are that you're saying? For example, I've come across like Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Like, I have no idea what any of that means.
Yeah.
But these texts say, just say it all day long, no matter what. Is that true? Like, I know syntax isn't semantics.
Well, yes,
right?
And
so
no.
If I'm saying the words, but I don't know the meaning.
Yeah, well, a question that comes up in one of the ancient texts that talks about mantras and their potency or efficacy is, if you know about fire and you touch it, does it burn or not burn? What's the answer? It burns, yeah. So mantras have potency. And if you know or not, or you don't know, then they'll still have an effect. However, there is a way in which, if you want to actually advance in the practice of mantra meditation, the more you learn about the mantra and what it means, and the more you get in touch with why you're saying it, the more effect it will have, because you're able to really focus your attention on it. Because the mind is unlimitedly fickle and eager to run off and find something else. So there's an old phrase, "Nam bina kichinahi ka oro chota bhuvanamaje." It's a mantra meant for those who are meditating on mantras. And it's in this mantra, there's nothing else in the world to be had except in this mantra. It all comes from here. So then you can inform your mind, you know, you don't need to go shopping, it's all here. So when you know more about the mantra, it's like sometimes if a doctor tells you more about the medicine and you get more faith in it, like, oh yeah, this could actually work. There was a double-blind study, you know, didn't just work on rats, it works on human beings. The reason is there's this chemical and it affects the, help me out here, something. Huh?
Receptors.
Yeah, the receptors, and because of that, that's why you feel better. And they're like, yeah, okay, now I really, you know, you can be, even become an advocate then. It's like, yeah, you should take this. I heard about it, double-blind studies and so forth. So there's this concept called Shraddha. So this word, sometimes it's translated as faith. But faith, you know, kind of in our modern culture, it sounds like, you know, something wispy or insubstantial, but according to the Gita, we are made of our faith, because we don't move without it. You don't walk across the street until you have a sense that you're going to be okay going across the street and so forth. It's a dual word. Da is an active verb. It means where you place something, and shrad means the heart. So shraddha means what you're putting your heart into. And so when you get more knowledge about a mantra and you put your heart into it, you put your attention to it, there's much more effect, because there's a reciprocation.
Greater concentration.
Much greater concentration when you know what you're doing.
Makes sense.
So there's a principle called niyamagraha in the practice of yoga, and again another Sanskrit dual word. Niyama means rules, and agraha means to not follow them. And niyamagraha with a long A means that you follow them but you don't know what you're doing. So it says, don't do either of these. Don't give up the niyamas or the rules to follow this, but also don't just follow it for the sake of following and find out what you're doing, because it'll have much more effect. Because there's only so far that cultural momentum or a little bit of early enthusiasm can carry you. You have to go a little more deeply into the science.
The other question is, some yogis and philosophers talk negatively about mantra. Krishnamurti, for example, says it'll make your mind numb, you won't think very well, don't do it, which I don't agree with personally. It seems to me to bridge the gap between your formal practices in some way.
Sure.
But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'm definitely an advocate of mantra. Yeah.
But why is that viewpoint wrong? You know, why is this the question, I guess?
Well, I'd have to know more specifically the context of what any particular philosopher said, because I would hate to, you know, within a limited context, you know, make a comment on it, because oftentimes it comes from a much bigger context and idea about, you know, that he's trying to present. And so a lot of times it goes back to the basic core of what the goal of the practice is. Because oftentimes, and the goal of the practice is different than the description of the different ways of practicing is gonna be different. There's what's called sadhya, which means the goal of yoga, and the sadhana, which means the practice that gets you there. So, you know, if you're gonna learn the banjo, there's a certain kind of sadhana for the banjo. And a good teacher who already knows it will say, here's what you have to do every day in order to learn to play the banjo. So in a similar way, that the goal of mantra, in the way it's described in some schools of yoga, is different than perhaps other philosophers. So they'll, since their goal is different, they'll describe the effects differently and say it's negative. Okay, so we came together and we definitely talked a little bit about mantra, and we actually practiced some mantra. And I'm hopeful that it left you with some feeling of improvement or a tool that you can take away so you can use on your own. Also on this card at the end, you'll see we have now follow-ups to these sessions on the back of the card at the very bottom, spiritual fitness. We have online regularly on Zoom calls and Facebook. A lot of people join in to ask more questions about their practice or to get more information from the Vedas about it. And the timing is there also, so you can check in if you like. Are there any last questions or comments? Okay, it's exactly 4 o'clock. So what we normally do here at Salesforce, for anybody who wants to have an extra session about mantra meditation, we're going to convene right up here in the front in a small circle, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about mantra and give you another mantra that you can take with you. And we also have some bees there, 27, not 108, because 108 is a little bit daunting, but 27 is nice for a home practice for starters.
Four of those.
Okay, you'll take four.
Four, give them four. Four make 108, right?
That's right. That's why, you know, it's either 108 or multi or divisions of that in equal parts that we do. And now we know why, because you were here. So it's been delightful being with you. Thank you for giving your unabated attention throughout this short presentation. And I look forward to seeing you all soon, either online or back here at the best company on the earth, Salesforce. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Shishika, for coming and giving us this enlightening talk. Thank you all for joining us online and input and people who have come here. Like Vaisheshika mentioned, we do have a mantra meditation workshop now, so you can all come in the front, and we also get a set of beads. And we also have a snack, vegan and gluten-free snack. Please grab them. And thanks to Ankita, who's part of this Conscious Living at Salesforce group, and also all of you. And we also want to thank Ken, who helped us with the setup, and Jonathan Loop for the digital screens. And yes, that's it. Thank you.